was like 25. And there were so many other churches in the area. There's, imagine in a town the size of Sexsmith, a little bit bigger than Sexsmith, there's 14 churches. Some of them were 500 or 600 people. So I kid you not, I mean, I was fresh from seminary. I was ready to change the world, people. I was going to get out there and change the world. You guys just watch, right? And I collected all the names of the new people to the community and phoned them to do a telephone survey about Christianity, just to find out who was actually not going to church somewhere. That's what it was like. So I was also a new dad. I was trying to do God's work, but I felt nothing was going well and I was not doing anything right. And I knew about God refining people in the Bible. I had studied passages like what we're going to look at today. I'd studied these sorts of passages, but I didn't feel it really helped. Because I'm telling you, that difficult period of time just went on and on and on. Like, I felt like, I know everything I can learn from this desert time right now, God. Can we just move on? Nope. I'm going to spend a little bit more time there. I mean, and don't think I was a hero. I was willing to just bail on those guys. I was looking at other churches. I was hoping to get on somewhere. I was looking at secular jobs. And for months, really nothing was coming together. So I know all of that sounds like an ordinary story from life. And that just is something that happens to you when you're young and you don't have a lot of other transferable skills. Apparently, spending 6 years in Bible school training and graduate study training doesn't prep you for many other things besides working in a church. So you wouldn't be hired on as a welder or something like that very easily. And so I felt from the perspective of faith, it was a time where God was refining Jill and I, that it was a changing time. It was a difficult time. And really that's what the book of Isaiah is about. If you want to turn today to Isaiah 1, we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah was a tough guy. I don't know if you've read the book of Isaiah lately. Isaiah wasn't the kind of person you want to have over for supper. He was edgy. You know, just one of those guys who would point out the faults in other people. That's what my perception of that guy. And so Isaiah chapter 1 is a summary of the entire book. What's going to happen in the whole book? Spoiler alert, it's not going to be a lot of fun. No surprise. Isaiah chapter 1, verses 22 to 23. Speaking, of course, to the nation of Israel in the ancient world, Isaiah wrote at about 800 BC. As you may know from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the best of the Dead Sea Scrolls is a big scroll of Isaiah, which you can go see in the Museum of the Scrolls in Tel Aviv, if you wish. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 22, once like pure silver, you have become like worthless slag. Once so pure, you are now like watered down wine. Your leaders are rebels, the companions of thieves. All of them love bribes and demand payouts, but they refuse to defend the cause of orphans or fight for the rights of widows. Once so pure. You guys were with it. You were on fire for God. You were his people. But now you've lost it. You've lost your purity. You're still his people, but you've lost your purity. The commentator notes worthless slag. When he talks about slag, we're going to talk about refining today, like metallic refining, which I saw a YouTube video of this guy who refines stuff. He takes like aluminum bike wheels and melts them down into like blocks, and it shows how to do that. It's really great. You should look it up. Anyhow, if you don't have a nice pure piece of metal, in this case we're talking about a nice pure piece of silver, you take it from the dirt, from the ground, and you refine it. There'll be silver, and then there's this stuff called lead oxide that attaches to the silver. And so when you melt it down, the silver will be in one level, and the lead oxide will be on top. And so when it's cooled, you can just knock the lead oxide off. I've likened it, by the way, just for helping you. to when you get an ice cap, when Ethan gets an ice cap and we've accidentally ordered whipped cream and he doesn't like whipped cream, we would just slice off the whipped cream from the top and the pure ice cap would be underneath. How do I come up with these illustrations? I know, it's a gift. It's a gift I have. Okay, well, he goes on in Isaiah 1, verse 24. Therefore, the Lord of heaven's armies, the mighty one of Israel, says, I will take revenge on my enemies and pay back my foes. I will raise my fist against you. I will melt you down and skim off your slag. I will remove all your impurities. Then I will give you good judges again and wise counselors like you used to have. And Jerusalem will again be called the home of justice and the faithful city. So last time I was here, I talked about something similar, which is the dark night of the soul. I unintentionally have created a series of that one might call why God would do bad things to you. So this is in essence part two. Last time, you'll remember, the dark night of the soul is when you're following God and everything's going pretty well, but God himself pulls away from you. So Christian writers through the centuries have noticed that we're not really doing anything bad, but all of a sudden I just feel like there's this distance. All my prayers just hit the ceiling and bounce down. And for some people, it goes on for a number of years. And it's a kind of a test for you to keep pursuing God, even though you don't get that feeling. I don't know what your Christian walk was like, but I would have times where I just feel the presence of God right next to me as I'm praying. Well, what if we just take that away? What if you're still praying? God's distant. That's called the dark night of the soul. This is something different. This is where you're one of God's children and you just blow it off. You're done with this. You're going to walk away. And this is, of course, at a national level. This isn't saying that every individual is going to have these terrible things happen to them every time if they're once a follower of God and then they leave. But at a national level, this is what he does. And I think to some degree, at an individual level, he does do the same thing to us. We experience sort of the same thing. That's kind of part of God's operating system. I don't know how much refining he's going to bring into our lives or when, but it's clear that if we turn away, he may try to retrieve us by having bad things happen to us to get our attention. I feel like this is happening to a former student of mine right now who's him joining an electrical company. He's an apprentice electrician, but him joining that electrical company automatically makes them not have any work. It's just incredible. He just keeps joining the last 2 years, and I'm like, what's going on with this guy? And I think this might be God trying to get your attention, you know, because he's doing some things that are, you know, aren't good right now. Well, as I said, we're looking at a national level of disobedience, right? So God's people, the Israelites, had fallen into idolatry and had really just fallen away from him. And so we see in verse 24, his judgment of them doesn't sound very good. He calls them enemies in verse 24. Never a good sign when God considers you an enemy. Then it says, I will raise my fist against you, verse 25. And finally, he says he will skim off their slag, which is where I get the title for this message, right? Just refining, because that's what that is. That's what skimming off slag is. Again, the ice cap illustration from moments ago. Okay, well, great. Okay, I'm with you so far. Nation, ancient world, followers of God, they're done with God. God's not done with them. He's going to bring them back, have something bad happen to them. Like what? Dot, dot, dot. What would that even look like? How do you get the attention of an entire nation? Is that even possible? Do you have like a whole bunch of internet ads that pop up when they're watching YouTube? It's like, oh, it's God's internet ad again. Oh, wow, I just got to skip it, right? No, you don't. You have to skip down to chapter 36. So that's what we're going to do now. There's a whole bunch of other things that are said, but in Isaiah 36, we have what the refining will look like. God had a plan for them. Verses 25 to 26 said his actions would be successful. Hey, was God's plan for their lives prosperity? Kinda, but not prosperity like you sitting by a pool sipping a nice drink. It's going to be prosperity that comes after a whole bunch of bad things happen. So, I remember reading a quick history of Hezekiah and the times in the ancient Israel, how things were going. At that time, King Hezekiah, which was the king when Isaiah was around, that was the king in Israel, and he was a vassal of Assyria. Assyria was a large nation north of Israel. So if we have the Mediterranean, I didn't bring a map. I should have brought a map. Mediterranean Sea, Israel's right next to the Mediterranean. Up here is Assyria. Of course, down here is Egypt. Mortal enemies, the superpowers of the land. Guess who is in between the two superpowers? That's where God put his nation. Not Switzerland. Switzerland's way over here, up in the mountains. No one can get to Switzerland. That's why Switzerland always is neutral, by the way. Can't get there. Mountains. Everyone's armed, also, by the way. Israel is on a flat, nice plain next to some good water sources. It's a great place to march your army through if you want to get to the other superpower and vice versa. Okay, quick history lesson for you. All right. So, he was a vassal of Assyria at that moment in time. But Assyria was having some problems. Kind of like the U.S. right now. All their leaders seem a little crazy, right? And unlike the U.S., they're kind of losing control of their military. The king of Assyria, a guy named Sennacherib, was in trouble. He was having other vassals rebel and leave his little empire. And he himself was having trouble in the court. I believe he survived an assassination attempt. That's just what my memory is bringing up right now. But it was a mess. Great time to bail if you're one of his vassals. When I say vassal, hey, what does that mean? Do you have to wear a weird hat? What happens? Oh, it's just like paying gobs and gobs of money. It's like being a tenant and your landlord's a jerk and just asks for pretty much all the money you have every year. You can see why he'd want to leave that arrangement. And so he thinks, hey, Assyria's in trouble. We're just going to rebel, which means we're not going to kill anybody. We're just going to stop paying the tax. We're just going to stop paying our rent. You know, we're going to be one of those free men on the land things where we just declare that, you know, we don't have to pay rent anymore, whatever. And you know what? If everything goes badly, we call on the other superpower, Egypt, to help us. Egypt always wants to invade Assyria. Anyhow, we'll just call on those guys. Done. How did it turn out? Spoiler alert, it turned out really badly. Really bad. I'm not going to read all of Isaiah 36 to you right now. I'll let you do that in your own time. I'm just going to do sum up. A massive army from Assyria shows up on Hezekiah's doorstep. The king of Assyria, Sennacherib, gets his stuff together and miraculously pulls off a kind of reverse coup, consolidates his power, and reattaches all of his vassals. Guess who's left on the hit list? Yes, the little tiny nation of Israel. We're going to teach them a bit of a lesson. Yes, that's what we're about to do. We pick up the story in Isaiah 36, where the Assyrian commander has conquered all of Israel down to Jerusalem. Jerusalem's about midway through Israel. He's conquered all those lands. The Assyrian commander, this is something you may remember, gives an ultimatum to King Hezekiah, and by extension to anyone who happens to be listening on top of the wall. You remember, he gives a big speech. I'm talking to the king in the common language, and I'm going to tell you what's going on. Here's what he says. Verse 5, 36:5. First of all, he's told that he is a rebel, which is technically true. He is asked where the source of his confidence is, and he is told that Egypt can't be counted on, which is right. Where is Egypt anyhow? I thought we were going to call on them, throw them some money, ask for a favor. They march their army up. They drive off the Assyrians. The Egyptians took a pass. So far, so badly. Verse 10, this is a quote. What's more, do you think we have invaded your land? Get this. Do you think we have invaded your land without the Lord's direction. The Lord himself told us, attack this land and destroy it. Were the Assyrians followers of God too? No, but they're kind of followers of all gods. And if a prophet comes to you and says he's from the Lord and says attack, you do it. Boy, that must have been devastating, right? Because that's the ace in the hole for the Israelites, is God is going to defend them. And then they find out God is the one who brought this army down here. Finally, verse 18, don't let Hezekiah mislead you by saying the Lord will rescue us. Have the gods of any other nations ever helped save their people from the king of Assyria? By the way, this sounds kind of weird. Bit of a history lesson today, doing a lot of history today. The king of Assyria is a guy named Sennacherib. His writings are still available. You can actually see them online. And so he has this same event recorded in his writings when he got back to Assyria. And here's how he describes how things went. As to Hezekiah, the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to countless small villages in their vicinity, and conquered them by means of well-stamped earth ramps, which is to say you build a, if there's a wall, let's say there's a wall the height of that ceiling, what you do is you start here and you build a dirt ramp up to the wall, stamp it all down, and then you and your army just race up the ramp. By the way, don't get a job building those ramps. It's a great way to get filled with arrows. All right? What's a 1,000-foot soldiers to me anyhow? Go ahead and build that ramp. You'll be fine, fellas. Be fine. Okay. Anyhow, blah, blah, blah. I conquered a bunch of cities. And battering rams brought thus near to the walls combined with the attack of foot soldiers. So in Sennacherib's view, this is what he did. I think it feels sometimes, just to give a bit of application here, it feels like when we're in those times, when our city is metaphorically surrounded by tens of thousands of enemy soldiers, that we wonder where God is in the middle of that. Isn't God's intent for us that we be happy all the time? Isn't God's intent for us that we feel good all the time? And if we're not, maybe there's something wrong with my faith, or maybe I'm just misperceiving what God's doing and I need to recite to myself that I'm actually doing really well. How could any type of bad feeling have its origin in God? This refiner's crucible is a place of questions rather than answers. When I'm in that kind of situation, I'm the one being refined. It brings a lot of questions to me. Whenever I talk about this, I think of the story of David out in the desert for long periods of time, not once but twice in his life. Once you may remember, he was chased out of his home by Saul and hunted in the hills, and the second time by his own son Absalom. And again, he was chased into what's called the wilderness, the area around the Dead Sea, which really is an old school wilderness. There aren't any trees or anything there. It's a hot, dry, dusty place. Israel did not prosper when David was out there, nor did he expand his personal wealth or fame in the desert, and yet this seems to have been a big part of his life. Moses himself, you may remember, was driven away and was a shepherd of sorts for 40 years. How could that have been part of God's plan? 40 years? Surely that could have been done more efficiently. I'm telling you, I felt the same way when we were back in Altona, where it seemed like the bad times in our lives just went on and on and on. And I thought, I've learned everything I can from this terrible experience. However, being a humble shepherd taught Moses a lot of things, and the Lord wanted to teach him even more. And these are different things he was being taught, faith things, interesting things. And as I said, when we're in that crucible time, we're in that difficult time, it is a place of questions, but that's not always bad for us. We question our faith. We question to see the bad things in our faith. What am I thinking wrong? Not just what I'm doing wrong. What am I thinking wrong? Do I need to make some kind of a change in my life? The Lord has all the answers. I don't have the answers. He has the plan. I don't see it all the time. I have to trust that this time will be useful, even though I can't see that right now. And I'll tell you, when I was a 25-year-old seminary grad thinking it was going to change the world, it was so confusing to just see failure at every attempt. But I was being taught things. I don't want to come back and say that I'm a super person because I was there, but that was part of the process of God refining Jill and I. Secondly, when we're in those times, it doesn't mean God's done with you. You may feel God's done with you, that you're no longer any useful to him. But I'd like to tell you that in those times in your life, you've never been in a better place to get close to God, to hear his still small voice that Darren talked about today, rather than talking over him, to let him show you his care rather than your strength, and to put away your selfies and to be a blessing to others even in your defeat. This is the upside down kingdom, Jesus says. Matthew 12, verse 20 is describing Jesus. It says, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench until he brings justice to victory. What does that even mean? I don't know if you caught all that. A bruised reed he will not break. If you see the reeds in the ditches, we have something similar with cattails. A bruised reed that's not quite nice and straight and firm, it's just about to fall over. And if you're a little kid walking by, I don't know what your childhood was like, but in Moose Jaw there's lots of these sorts of things. And it's just so tempting to see a bruised reed and just snap it. And there's just something about that, isn't it? You can see this if you come over to our house. A ripped sock, Ethan will shred. My son, if he's wearing socks, and the sock has just a little hole in it, and he's left alone, all of a sudden you hear this ripping sound. Because you can get your fingers in the hole. Because my son has autism, Ethan has autism. And it just feels like just shredding it would make sense. Doesn't this make sense? Yeah. Paper, your shirt. We don't have a lot of old raggedy clothes. Like, why the gay guys never wear any old raggedy clothes? No, they're all in little pieces in our basement. It says, Jesus, he will not break a bruised reed. It's interesting, the church is compared to reeds, not oaks, and bruised rather than whole reeds. And so this is the description, of course, of a poor, distressed person. When we're in our time of distress, the Lord doesn't break us. He works with us. This is God's character coming to light. You know, after all the junk the Israelites pulled in the Old Testament, a lot of people have said, why didn't God just start over? You know, at one point he was going to do that. But a bruised reed he will not break. This is for our good, because a reed before the bruise has more air than pulp. And you'll notice this if you have tomato plants. I've got a lot of tomato plants, and they fall over and then they'll rip. The stem will rip, but at that rip, it's actually extra strong. If you touch it later, it's quite firm, whereas the rest of the twig is loose. Okay, I'm doing this thing where I'm going back and forth between application and the story, right? It's the teaching method I'm using today. See if that works. So, back to the historical story of this massive and determined army which had surrounded the city of Jerusalem. Hezekiah is completely out of options. There's another account, there's a parallel account of this in 2 Kings 18. In that place, Hezekiah goes to the temple, takes all the gold in the temple, and hands it to the king of Assyria. Right? So don't you mean, Jason, he went to the temple and he prayed and he pleaded with the Lord and it fixed things? Well, kind of. He does that later. At this point, he just takes all the money he can find and just throws it at the wall. Hey, have some money. Anyone want some money? Yeah. You know? Either the passage in 2 Kings 18 is describing a separate incident in which the Assyrians left and then came back, which is unlikely, or more likely, they took all that money and kept charging. See, there's never a guarantee. People are so tricky, aren't they? Throw gold at them to move their army and they just take your gold. lesson there for all of us, really. So now he has no gold and no allies to call upon. Egypt is nowhere. But he had three things going for him. He had the Lord, the prophet of the Lord, Isaiah, and prayer. And out of his desperation, Hezekiah, who is a guy who probably would have been happy to be saved by gold or allies, now turns completely to God, to the mercy of God. Isaiah 37, verse 14. After Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers, from the Assyrian messengers telling him to surrender, and he read it, he went up to the Lord's temple and spread it out before the Lord. Which I think is cool. I think we just take our troubles and we do the same thing. We just spread it out before God. And sometimes our hearts just have nothing left. You know what I'm saying? That we have nothing to offer God. All we have is our needs. And we spread that out before the Lord. I don't like coming to that point. I've come to that point sometimes in my life. But that's sometimes all we have, is that pure faith in God, nothing else. And this comes out in his prayer. He says, O Lord of heaven's armies, God of Israel, you are enthroned between the mighty cherubim. You alone are God of all the kingdoms of the earth. You alone created the heavens and the earth. Bend down, O Lord, and listen. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. Listen to Sennacherib's words of defiance against the living God. It is true that the kings of Assyria have destroyed all these nations, and they have thrown the gods of these nations into the fire and burned them. But of course, the Assyrians could destroy them. They were not gods at all, only idols of wood and paper. Now, O Lord God, rescue us from his power. Then all the kingdoms of the earth will know that you alone, O Lord, are God. Hey, God knew that he was Hezekiah's last option. And honestly, if I was God, I might be tempted to tell Hezekiah to get lost. But that's not how God reacted to all this. He could very legitimately have said, yeah, you've tried like a bunch of other things and now this has failed. And you've really dug this pit yourself. This is all your own doing from rebelling. Instead, God would react to this. God would help him. Sometimes people say that God will not listen to their prayers because they're sinners. And my first instinct is to tell them that God is gracious and that he isn't waiting for us to become perfect before he answers our prayers. And I think Hezekiah is the textbook example of that. But there's also some truth to this. There's a number of places in the Bible that say our sins keep God from hearing our prayers, which is the reason why our stuff isn't getting answered. And the solution is always the same, of doing that thing that Hezekiah does, is spreading out his plea, spreading out his heart, really, on the temple of the Lord and asking for help. And this really shows us who God is. He honors sincerity and faith, and he is merciful, which means that he helps when you don't deserve it. Don't try to think that you're going to suddenly deserve God's help, and that's why he's going to come to your aid. God is merciful. Again, the word mercy means to help, to give assistance when it is not justified, when it is not paid for, that he will help when you don't deserve it. Finally, we come to the victory. The Assyrian king had done well. He had indeed conquered all these lands, like he suggested. But the reason is revealed by God in chapters 37, verses 26 to 27. 26, but have you not heard? I decided this long ago. Long ago, God says, I planned it, and now I'm making it happen. I planned for you to crush fortified cities into heaps of rubble. That's why their people have so little power, and they are frightened and confused. They are weak as grass and easily trampled as tender shoots. I'm not an infinite being, so I don't understand why all this happens. But in other words, God is saying, long ago, long before anyone did anything, I knew this situation was going to be set up, and I set it up that this king was going to conquer. Verse 36, chapter 37, verse 36. That night the angel of the Lord went out to the Assyrian camp and killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Which is certainly a fast way of dealing with an incoming army. That wasn't the entire army, but that was a huge chunk of it. And verse 37, then King Sennacherib broke camp, so he wasn't killed. The king survived and returned to his own land. He went home to his capital of Nineveh and stayed there. Well, having most of your army mysteriously be killed is a good reason to quit an assault on a foreign country and to go home and recoup. But is that what really happened? Sennacherib does recall the end of the battle. Here's his account of what happened. Hezekiah himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, and he did. He surrounded the city by a moat and a wall, so no one could get in and out. It wasn't just that, like, the city was surrounded, so no one could come in and out. I surrounded him with earthwork in order to molest those who were leaving his city's gate. His towns, which I had plundered, I took away from his country and gave them over to Minti, king of Ashdod, Paddy, the king of Ekron, and Silabel, the king of Gaza. So all the cities that used to be Israel's city, I gave them to various kingdoms, which were his enemies, by the way. Thanks very much for that. Thus I reduced his country. And where's the part about destroying the rebel? It's not there. But I increased the tribute and the kutra presence due to me as his overlord, which I imposed later upon him beyond the former tribute to be delivered annually. So a guy rebels against you, leads a massive rebellion, and you come right up to his capital, conquer all the cities before, and then I'll show you, I'll put more taxes on you. I'm going back home, but I'm waiting till next year for those taxes. Huh. Like, you didn't kill him, I guess is what you're saying. You didn't kill the rebel king and replace him with your own puppet, which is what people do all the time. If you're a conquering nation, you kill the enemy rebel and you replace him with someone who'd do your bidding. You know, like this guy here, right? He seems like a pliable guy, put you in charge of the nation, you supply taxes, it's great. Right? Anyone, someone who's on my team. No. No. He says he bailed and he went back home. He doesn't say anything about having 185,000 guys killed, but clearly something happened that just stopped him. He didn't go down to attack Egypt. He could have done that. He just left. And in his words, you know, he's not going to say he was defeated. He's just saying, I found something better to do. Interesting. Anyhow, that's all available on the internet if you're interested in looking that up. I'll show you where. You know, I'd like to say that our time in that little town was an amazing, refining experience. And now, as I said, and now I'm this perfect minister who has tons of faith and strength. And I don't want to say that any time we go through those changing experiences, they're suddenly going to change us, because change comes slowly. But I tell you, I did learn some lessons from that. I certainly learned to rely more on God. I learned not to rely as much on myself. I certainly sought God's help many more times than I would have if everything was going well. That's really the problem with success, isn't it? You start to attribute it to yourself. You start to say that I'm the reason things are going well. And we forget God. So, I mean, to this day, I teach the pastoral students. I'm the pastoral ministries director at the school. I teach the guys, the young students, I tell them, get as many mentors as you can. You know, surveys show that one of the big predictors of success as a minister is whether you have an outside mentor that can be called upon for the many, many situations one gets into in a church. Have advisors who can help in whatever ministry you're in, and make sure you have lots of good books along with you. For our little story in that little town, things did turn around for us, and I think in somewhat of a miraculous way. I told you, I think, one time about the phone call I got about a guy telling me that things were going to go better for us. It was so random. I got a phone call from a musician who was going to be a musician, do a musical number at this big church in town, the big church, and instead of calling them, he accidentally called me, and we just talked for a while. And he asked me how old I was after I told him my sad story. And he said, well, Jason, the next 10 years of your life are going to go well. And I don't think he was being prophetic. I think he was just saying, at this time in your life, God usually works things out like this. And he was right. It wasn't long after that we became the caretakers of the apartment building we were in. And so we didn't have to pay rent anymore, and we got some extra income through that. And then soon afterwards, the plumbers would come through the apartment building, and I said to Jill, if I could do something else, I wouldn't mind trying that. It just seems sort of interesting. I'd never done anything like that in my life. And that same company, that little plumbing company, all of a sudden needed somebody. And I applied there and told them I had zero experience in plumbing and literally didn't know what that wall looked like without the drywall on it. And they said, you're hired. And I continued working there for the next 2 years, which really helped, by the way. I mean, in a little blue-collar town like that, having a master's degree in divinity, that's my degree. Did you know that? I have a master of divinity. Oh, yeah. How relatable do you think that made me? Right? Well, that doesn't sound very practical. They had no idea what that was, right? It doesn't make you super, like, I don't know, relatable to typical blue-collar folks. And so instead, I worked as a plumber. Boy, did I have stuff to talk to people about then, because I'd be working on those apartment buildings. You know the apartment buildings over there that are all on one floor that have floor heat? What's the floor heat like? How do you install that? Well, I'll tell you, there's a header, and I put it in, and it goes like this. Wow, tell us more. Oh, teacher, right? All of a sudden, I was the guy to talk to. It was amazing, right? All of that just started to change, and I think part of it is I needed to go through that refining process before I would accept a job like that, before I was kind of desperate enough to do something like that. And sure enough, to this day, I am still doing plumbing-related stuff, even this summer at the school. They still get me to do things like that. Through the next church I was in, and by the way, after that church, it's interesting because on the night I resigned from that little church, I had already kind of applied at another church but hadn't heard anything. The night I resigned, I got a phone call from another church asking if I could start there. And that would start an 8-year wild ride for our family. Doing things that I felt, it was a much more normal church. I fit in a lot better. A lot better things happened, by the way, at that place. And really, it was a lot more fun in a lot of ways. But I think we kind of had to go through that difficult time. And I don't know where you're at. If you're going through one of those times, or if you know someone who is, you have to know that this is part of God's plan, that I can't see it, but as I'm a faithful Christian, I can trust that these things that are going wrong are somehow part of God's plan. And I never try to explain how, because I don't always understand how. Honestly, even in the Old Testament, as we read that story, there's a lot of mess, wasn't it? Like a whole bunch of cities got conquered. That is not fun. So I don't have the mind of an infant being. I can't explain to you how your refining moment is helping you. I just know that ultimately God's plan for us is redemption and turning us into something useful. And we trust him in that. Why don't I close in prayer before inviting the team back up. God, we thank you that you carry out your plan in this world. Even though clearly you don't always step in every situation. But we thank you that in our lives, in the big picture, you bring forth things that bring refining and redemption and cleansing. And God, as we go through those times, I pray that you give us patience. Help us in the end to come to that point where we don't look to our own strength, but we look to you. And we do like Hezekiah did and kind of spread out our needs before you and look up to you, God, rather than to looking to our own power or to allies. We ask in Jesus' name.
Thank you for that, Jason. Just invite you to stand.